This recording is the property of the Winogren Foundation and cannot be copied, transcribed, or rebroadcast without the express permission of the Foundation. This is the New York Academy of Sciences Anthropology Section's lecture series at the Winogren Foundation for October 27th, 2014. Is Clovis Still First? Presented by Stuart J. Fidel, Senior Archaeologist at the Lewis Berger Group.
Okay, hello everyone. Thanks for coming. Nice to see a good crowd here tonight. Welcome to the New York Academy of Sciences at the Winogren. This is the next in our series of the migration lectures, which is our theme this semester. My name is Brian Boyd. This is Janice Sodikoff, my co-chair. A couple of quick announcements before we hear from tonight's guests. Our next meeting is Monday, November 17th, and that's a panel with Daniel Goldstein from Rutgers and Alicia Galvez from Lehman CUNY on immigration subjectivities and post-migration capitalism. And that will be the final session of this particular semester. We'll start again late January with when our theme is the Anthropocene. Everyone's saying Anthropocene in the States. Anthropocene in my British accent, okay. Okay, I have two guests to announce to you tonight. Our speaker tonight is Dr. Stuart Fidel. Stuart, if I may, is a native of the Bronx. After he graduated from the Bronx High School of Science in 1969, he did his BA in anthropology at Columbia, 1973, and his doctorate at the University of Pennsylvania, 1979. His original research focus was the Neolithic of what we call the Near East, and that's where I first came across his work when I was an undergraduate, actually. His PhD thesis was on Mesolithic and early Neolithic mortuary practices, still very heavily referenced within those of us doing mortuary archaeology in the Near East today. While teaching at SUNY at Purchase, he then shifted his research interests to the New World. And since the mid-80s, he's been working in cultural resource management archaeology. And since 2001, he's been senior archaeologist with the Lewis Berger Group. He published Prehistory of the Americas, Cambridge University Press, 1987, revised edition 92, Spanish translation 96. And he's published many, many articles on a range of topics in both new and old world archaeology. You probably know his work on radiocarbon calibration, origins of the European Neolithic, particularly some environmental concerns in there that we've been talking about in our meetings, the Younger Dryas, terminal Pleistocene, megafaunal extinctions, and so on. But tonight he's going to talk to us about Paleo-Indian migration, with the title, Is Clovis Still First? Our discussant following Dr. Fidel's talk is Professor Peter Siegel, who's Professor and Chair of Anthropology at Montclair State, specializes in the prehistory of the Caribbean, lowland South America, and eastern North America. Since 2007, Peter's been leading an interdisciplinary team collecting paleoecological data to address colonization processes and socio-natural landscapes in the southern and eastern Caribbean. So please welcome both Peter and Dr. Stuart Fidel. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. It's good to be here and see a lot of familiar faces from the New York area. I'll launch right into the presentation because I'm going to try to cover a lot of territory. Until recently, we thought we knew where ancestral Native Americans came from, central Siberia, then across Beringia, and down through the ice-free corridor between the Laurentian and Coeur d'Alene ice sheets. And when they arrived, about 13,500 to 13,000 calendar years ago, it's roughly 11,000, 11,500 radiocarbon years, they're not the same, and they arrived after a trek between the ice sheets. The ubiquitous Clovis fluted points in North America and the stylistically derivative Fell 1 or Magellan fishtail points of Central and South America seem to mark the path of the first Paleo-Indian colonists. The sudden extinction of 32 genera of giant mammals in North America and about 50 genera in South America appeared to have been largely caused by these newly arrived hunters. However, recent archaeological finds and analyses of crania and molecular data have been widely construed as validating an alternative pre-Clovis paradigm. Fashionable and widely publicized theories envision multiple pre-Clovis migrations, including trans-Pacific or coastal voyages by ancestral Australians or Melanesians or Ainu, and even a transatlantic migration by Caucasoid Solutrians from Iberia. However, close examination of the new finds will show, I hope, that they are dubious, and the theories based on them have factual and logical weaknesses. The Clovis first model remains the only coherent explanation for data derived from geology, climatology, paleontology, archaeology, and increasingly molecular genetics. Indeed, the most recent findings from each of these disciplines, far from challenging this model, actually provide additional support for it. The Clovis first model, which was developed in the mid-1960s, mainly by Vance Haynes at the University of Arizona, has been challenged continually by advocates for various allegedly pre-Clovis sites. As the evidence for one set of ostensibly promising sites fails to withstand close critical scrutiny, pre-Clovis enthusiasts pin their hopes on the latest contenders. Currently, their favorites are Monte Verde in southern Chile, the Deborah L. Friedkin site in Texas, and the Paisley Caves in southern Oregon. The evidence from both Monte Verde and Paisley Caves has been deployed both by archaeologists and geneticists in support of a model of pre-Clovis migration along the Pacific coast, this despite the continuing absence of any sites older than about 13,200 calendar years ago along the entire coast from Alaska to Tierra del Fuego. Let's look at Monte Verde. Monte Verde was excavated from 1977 to 1985, and the massive final report was published in 1997. It's about 1,300 pages long. In that year, a delegation of prominent Paleo-Indian specialists visited the site, looked at artifacts, and declared this site a proven pre-Clovis site with a date of around 12,300 radiocarbon years, or about 14,400 or 500 real years. If people had reached southern South America by that date, they must have been in North America centuries earlier. But without Monte Verde, there is no need to postulate coastal migration or peopling before the ice-free corridor opened. So let's examine this supposed evidence of a pre-Clovis presence. Not even the excavator, Tom Dillehay, argues strongly that the 33,000-year-old stuff called Monte Verde I, which consists of 26 broken rocks and some clay and peat stringers, really represents a human campsite. That leaves only Monte Verde II on the other side of the creek to consider. Multiple radiocarbon dates of around 12,300 radiocarbon years indicate an age of about 14,500 to 14,000 calendar years, and the paleobotanical evidence is congruent with a well-delineated regional sequence in southern Chile. Why, then, do I regard Monte Verde as bizarre and anomalous? First off, unlike every Stone Age campsite that I've ever worked on or examined or read about, there's no debitage. If humans lived at this site for an extended period, they apparently never had to resharpen a stone tool. And you know, I can tell you, in my line of work, we recognize prehistoric sites by the presence of debitage. So a Stone Age site without chipping debris is very peculiar, to say the least. There are gomphothere bones at Monte Verde. Gomphothere was a primitive form of elephant. But there's no clear evidence of butchering. There are no shaped bone or ivory tools. The half-dozen indubitable stone artifacts lack verifiable provenience. The original contexts were not mapped, and Dillehay has prevented various conflicting accounts of their discovery. The site plans of Monte Verde are unreliable and internally contradictory, and crucial measurements are demonstrably mistaken. For example, that's the famous or infamous healer's hut where supposedly leaves were chewed and applied medicinally to heal ailing people. It's about a meter in full extent. Dillehay repeatedly has said it's 9 meters, 9 square meters. Well, it's obviously not. He can't read his own photographs. That's the same structure. You can see its actual size relative to the excavators. And then there's the famous footprint. And that's actually 12 and a half centimeters long. And when you look at the data on human footprints, there's been increasing attention to ancient footprints. There was a nice set discovered in Australia at Lake Mungo that's about 20,000 years old. That's an adult. There's a modern child's print for comparison. Clearly, this whatever this thing is at Monte Verde, it's not a child's footprint. There's no similar lithic industry anywhere in the world which would consist not of pebble tools or choppers, but actually just rocks picked up from a stream bed and used because they'd broken in a useful way or were rounded in a useful way. I mean, this is not the way humans have operated for the past, well, at least 3 million years. So, again, very odd. None of the other early Paleoindian sites that have been found in the southern cone at the southern tip of South America contain similar assemblages. Instead, they contain very nicely made Fell 1 fishtail points and other Clovis-like chipstone tools such as side scrapers. And none of those sites has yielded reliable dates that are appreciably earlier than 11,000 radiocarbon years. And another point I would emphasize is that if Monte Verde really is a human campsite, and I obviously have grave doubts about that, it's not a coastal site. It lies well inland on a small creek, and it contains no fish, no shellfish, no marine birds, and no marine mammals, although there is seaweed. And there's just no factual basis to connect this dubious site with hypothetical coastal migrants. So leaving Monte Verde in archaeological purgatory, I'll look at a few other pre-Clovis candidate sites briefly that are in North America and that are minimally credible. Another famous site is Meadowcroft Rock Shelter, located in southwestern Pennsylvania. This has been touted as a pre-Clovis site since the late 1970s by the excavator James Ottavasio. All these years later, he has yet to publish a final detailed report, and he probably never will because it doesn't suit his purposes. There are only about 750 artifacts and mere handfuls of bone fragments and plant remains from the lowest stratum, stratum 2A, which is what everybody's interested in. There are many thousands of other artifacts from the higher strata, but those are archaic and woodland and are quite uncontroversial. So he can take as long as he wants with that. All he has to do is publish the 750 things from the bottom. And we who work in the contract business, you know, that would take about 2 months to publish a site with that much stuff in it, not 30 years. Now, there are some pre-11,000 radiocarbon dates from the bottom of Meadowcroft, but the associated biota are all of Holocene and not Pleistocene species. There's no mammoth, there's no horse, there's just deer and flying squirrel and snake. The artifacts include blades and bifaces. Now, there was one point found, Ottavasio called the Miller Lancelet, and he and his Associates reconstructed it as having once been a larger point that was worked down in use. And there are other points from western Pennsylvania, Ohio, southern Ontario that are rather similar and are generally regarded by people who work in the area as late Paleo-Indian forms that are post-Clovis. Well, oddly enough, there's also quite a resemblance of that's a late archaic type from the same area called Steubenville. And there is evidence, if you read the reports closely, that some things like potsherds did fall down cracks around the edges of the Meadowcroft site. Maybe it's a late archaic point that wedged its way down. I think it's more likely that it is a late paleo form. As at Meadowcroft, at the Cactus Hill site in southeastern Virginia, there are blades and bifaces, and they're associated with dispersed charcoal pieces that yielded pre-Clovis radiocarbon ages, in this case about 15 to 16,000 or 18 to 19,000 calendar years ago. Unlike Meadowcroft, there are Clovis points at this site and other Clovis tool types, and the ostensibly pre-Clovis artifacts lie a few inches below the Clovis zone. Unfortunately, there are also later archaic artifacts that are scattered unpredictably among the Clovis diagnostics and even below them. So that's where Clovis points were found. And that's an early archaic point. This is a middle archaic point. And these are not actual pits. The excavators basically imagine these as ways to account for these things having gotten to the depths at which they were found. And, you know, they admit that there is downward drift at the site because the matrix in which the artifacts occur is sand, and stuff just does drift lower in sand. The pre-Clovis assemblage has been constituted by an informed subtraction of those elements that are recognizably diagnostic of later periods. However, blades, cores, and bifaces similar to those found below Clovis are also reported from the overlying early archaic age strata. Also interesting is that there's a sharp drop in the absolute numbers of chipping debris as one descends into the lowest cultural zone. Here and elsewhere, it seems that the tool-making activities of pre-Clovis knappers inexplicably always produce less shatter than those of later people. And there's no physical reason why somebody sitting to make a tool at 15,000 years ago would produce less bits of debitage than somebody doing it 3,000 years ago. Now, I have to admit that a pretty convincing case for pre-Clovis occupation can be made for several mammoth death sites in Wisconsin. They're called Hebeor, Schaefer, and Mud Lake. Mud Lake, there's just some cut marks on the bones, but at Hebeor and Schaefer, they found a few flakes and a very crude biface. These are the flakes from the Schaefer site on the top. You probably can't see these, but the radiocarbon dates on the mammoth bones are mostly about 12,300, 12,400 radiocarbon years. That's about 14,500 or so calendar years. And that's the Hebeor mammoth. And in situ, when it was being excavated in a quite muddy matrix, this turned out, and that's the middle object in that display. Problem with this is it's a really crude thing. I know some people who've looked at it would say it's not even an artifact, really, and not something that would have been probably very useful in actually poking through the belly of a mammoth, and not a very effective butchering tool either. So what exactly is it doing there? How did it get under this animal? And there are some archaic sites not far away, and it's a very fluid, muddy matrix, so who knows how that thing got there. But all that being said, this is one of the more convincing cases. And it is interesting that from an entirely different line of evidence, there is something that happens about then in the Midwest and in southeastern New York, in Orange County, where there are some bog sites. There's a peak in charcoal peaks suddenly, and the vegetation changes. So spruce goes down, and ash and hornbeam suddenly go up. And this is the most important possible indicator of something really important going on and dramatic in ecology, which is the fungus of a dung-loving, the spores of a dung-loving fungus is called Sporormiella, suddenly drop off. And this has been interpreted as an indication of a major population decline of the big herbivores. The problem is, look at the date is about 14,000, 13,800 for this event. But there are well-dated fossil specimens, including from Hyde Park and Orange County and a number of Midwestern sites, that go down to about this date. So Mastodon must have continued pooping somewhere, but evidently they weren't doing it in these ponds. I suppose it's possible that the dating may be a bit iffy here. I wouldn't feel bad if we could push this up to about that date, to about 13.4, but maybe that can't be done. And if that's the case, we have to either find another explanation or posit that the first hunting peoples swarming through the continent were kind of cryptic and didn't make substantial camps, didn't use a lot of stone tools, and we don't see them until several hundred years after they've made their first pass through through North America. I'm kind of uncomfortable with that. Another long-known proboscidian death site was recently reanalyzed. That's the Manus mastodont that was found in the 1960s up in Washington State, and it's been dated to about 11,800 radiocarbon years or 13,700 calendar years. A sliver of bone was somehow driven into one of the ribs of this critter. CT scan suggests that it may have been the tip of a projectile. It's odd, however, that the DNA of the sliver shows that it also is made of mastodon bone, just like the animal that it somehow got lodged in. And it's very small compared to verified Upper Paleolithic bone points, and the possibility remains that it somehow got embedded when the skeleton was dislodged by heavy machinery in the 1960s. Another site that's much in the news in the last several years is Paisley Caves in southern Oregon. And that site is unique in that the evidence consists of both artifacts and directly dated ancient feces that have yielded human DNA. Dennis Jenkins, the excavator, and collaborating molecular geneticist reported in 2008 in Science that the coprolites contained human but also canid mitochondrial DNA dating to about 14,300 calendar years, radiocarbon data directly on the bone, the feces. Several months later, along with Hendrik Poynar and his students at McMaster in Canada, I noted chronological and stratigraphic problems and suggested that contamination by leaching might account for possibly exogenous human DNA in the coprolites, while Paul Goldberg and his students at BU, who had actually examined and sampled the coprolites, asserted that their morphology was inconsistent with human derivation. Jenkins and his colleagues subsequently undertook meticulous excavations and analyses that were designed to demonstrate that the radiocarbon dates are accurate and the coprolites have not been contaminated by leaching. They now assert that diagnostic Western stem tradition stone points and associated human coprolites date between 11,070 and 11,340 radiocarbon years. These are dates that overlap with dates for Clovis elsewhere. But that there are additional purported human coprolites that are pre-Clovis age, that is older than 11,600 radiocarbon years, and as old as 12,300 radiocarbon years. This entire assemblage is interpreted as conclusive evidence that the colonization of the Americas involved, I quote, multiple technologically divergent and possibly genetically divergent founding groups. Briefly, there's a kind of heroic shot of one of the problems. Briefly, the problems with this evidence are, first, one of the three labs, Brian Kemp's lab at Washington State, that was tasked with replicating the ancient DNA, found the dog or wolf or coyote DNA, but they couldn't extract any human DNA from the pre-Clovis feces. Two, the reported DNA sequences from both the earliest pre-Clovis feces and also feces dated 7,000 years later at the site are all of the same known Native American haplogroups A and B. However, both of these groups are very rare or absent in both the recent Numic-speaking peoples of that region and the sampled pre-Numic ancient inhabitants. What's predominant in those populations is haplogroup D, and that's not found in any of these samples from Paisley Caves. Also, a variant of haplogroup A that has as well as the signature of haplogroup A, the 9-base pair deletion that is typical of the B haplogroup, is reported from the feces. And this is very rare. It occurs only in Mexico today, and it seems to have arisen there within the last 1,000 years. So why is this clade, this called A2D1, present in what ought to be a founding population in the Great Basin, many thousands of years before the Aztec Empire emerged? Third point is a recent analysis by Goldberg's team found that the feces have a biochemical signature that is typical of herbivores and not humans. Specifically, they lack coprostenol, which is a distinctive marker of human as opposed to canine and herbivore feces. The claimed early dating of Western stem points at Paisley Caves has been linked to dubious dates from a few other sites in the Great Basin to support the idea that a pre-Clovis population came down the Pacific coast before 14,300 calendar years ago. This idea has been linked to discovery of unusual stone points on Santa Rosa and San Miguel Islands off Southern California. This was another Science article. But these things date to 12,000 calendar years ago, which is 1,000 years after Clovis, and yet they're cited as evidence of pre-Clovis migration along the coast. Simple logic tells us that there's a problem with this idea. The literature is now full of statements that the Western stem tradition developed in the northern Great Basin and persisted there and more broadly in the far west of the United States in isolation, while the unrelated Clovis culture developed in the plains and the southeast and had no Western presence. In fact, Clovis artifacts have been found throughout the Far West, including the spectacular cache that may be as old as 13,600 years from East Wenatchee in Washington State. Many classic Clovis spear points, as well as Western stem points, were found at the Dietz site, which is only 55 kilometers northeast of Paisley Caves, and Clovis hunters must have been regularly traversing the territory of whoever was occupying the caves. The advocates of an early Western stem presence have not explained how two distinct groups with very similar lake-oriented foraging adaptations and toolkits, apart from the spear points, could have coexisted for several centuries without competitive exclusion. These conundrums are avoided, though, if we reject the ambiguous evidence of pre-Clovis occupation and postulate instead a rapid transition across the region from Clovis to Western stemmed at the onset of the Younger Dryas cold period 12,800 years ago. Another site that was reported in Science, a favorite venue for these pre-Clovis announcements, is the Deborah Friedkin site in Texas. This site is a short distance away from a large Clovis quarry and campsite called Galt. At Friedkin, thousands of tiny flakes and a few larger tool fragments were excavated below Clovis artifacts, and later Paleo-Indian and archaic tools are stratified above the Clovis zone. There's no charcoal that could be used for radiocarbon dating, but optically stimulated luminescence, or OSL dating, of the sediments suggests that what they call the Buttermilk Creek complex could be as old as about 15,000 years. Complicating issues here are, first, OSL dates have large error factors. There's one date for the Clovis zone of like 14,300, which is obviously way too old. Second, the soils here are classified as vertisols, which means they, by definition, they frequently form large vertical cracks down which tiny artifacts may fall. And note that here 32B is the Clovis level, and as you go farther down in the sequence, you get fewer and fewer artifacts, a nice regular linear way. That's very suggestive that post-depositional drift has carried tiny artifacts down into deeper levels from the Clovis zone. And third point is that this assemblage has been described by Mike Waters, the excavator, and his students as nearly identical to the Aubrey site assemblage in northern Texas. But the thing is that Aubrey has has one fragment of a fluted point, and therefore Aubrey is a Clovis site. They haven't yet found any fluted points in the lowest zone at Buttermilk Creek, but everything else about it says Clovis, except these odd early dates. Now, moving back to the East Coast, a surprising number of Clovis points have been found on the Delmarva Peninsula in Maryland, many of them exposed by erosion of the Chesapeake Bay shoreline. And Darren Lowry, whom I'm in contact with about every week, has been out scouring the shore for decades, since he was a kid, and he's been finding these things all over. Several years ago, when he was at a local museum, he spotted a large rhyolite bipoint in a case there. It had reportedly been dredged up years ago by fishermen on a boat called the Sinmar, along with mastodon teeth in the same dredge episode, from a spot about 40 miles offshore and 75 meters below the present ocean surface. A C14 date was derived from the mastodon by Dennis Stanford at the Smithsonian. I mean, he didn't do it himself, but he sent it off. And it's about 26,000 calendar years ago. I would emphasize, though, there's no reason, just because the two things came up in the same dredging episode, to say they were deposited at the same time. I mean, if they found a beer bottle in the same dredge, you wouldn't say that, you know, the people who killed the mastodon were drinking Schlitz. So, now, at the Miles Point site, this is one of those eroding Chesapeake edge sites, there was a biface, it was kind of like a cactus hill point, also some blade cores and small blades, and the dating of the zone where they were derived, where that yellow arrow is about 30,000 calendar years, both OSL dates and radiocarbon dates. Recently, Darren has found some stuff eroding out of another Chesapeake bluff face. This is Parsons Island. There's the biface in situ. And Darren makes a good case that all of that tan zone above is a loess deposit, windblown sediment laid down during the Younger Dryas. And that would mean that this interface should be about 12,800 calendar years. But that's the date he got on some charcoal particles that were around the biface. Those are radiocarbon years. So that's roughly 20,000 calendar years. And that's what it looked like pulled out of the bank. And he found several others lying out on the beach in front of the exposed bank. Now, there are analogs in known Paleo-Indian assemblages to these things. The thing on the left is a Folsom ultra-thin from a site out west. I think it looks kind of similar to Darren's biface. And here's some more Folsom ultra-thins. There is no Folsom east of the Mississippi. So I'm not saying these are Folsom artifacts, but I'm saying there may be analogs to Folsom in a comparable time frame. That's a Clovis cache from Idaho, and again, there are these things not dissimilar. Compare that, and that's the Simon cache. That's one of Darren's bipoints. Now, most archaeologists have ascribed the similarities of French Solutrean and Clovis artifacts, and one could, by extension, say Darren's Chesapeake material, to convergence. But Dennis Stanford at the Smithsonian and his partner in crime, Bruce Bradley, have been arguing for about, I guess, 8 or 9 years now that actually the ancestors of Clovis came from Europe, that they were Solutreans. And that this must have happened about 19, 20,000 years ago. There are some undeniable superficial resemblances between some Clovis points and some Spanish Solutrean artifacts. But this doesn't look like anything in the Americas. These classic Volgu cache bifaces from France, and nor are there tang points, nor are there long tang points, nor obviously is there any art. The Solutreans made a lot of art in France and Spain, and maybe they, when they were sailing over in their leather boats, they pushed the only artist overboard because he wasn't useful, but the only arguably Clovis-derived piece of artwork is a very dubious thing from Florida that emerged from some amateur collectors. Actually, it was more like a professional collector for money who found this thing and supposedly had sort of held it under a light, and there was a small image of a mammoth on it, and he sent it to the Smithsonian, and five or six experts did various tests on it and said, oh, probably is genuine, and then he sold it once the value had been knocked up by the declaration of its authenticity. So why is the Solutrean hypothesis implausible? First, the Solutrean is replaced by the Magdalenian in Western Europe by about 19,000 calendar years ago, which was 6,000 years before Clovis appears. Second, we have to accept that 6 millennia or more of activity by highly efficient Upper Paleolithic big game hunters, they went after horses in Europe, had no discernible effect on the American fauna, which went extinct only at 12,800 years, right after Clovis points appeared. Third, these hunters must have left behind a meager archaeological record and no cave art comparable to what they had produced in Europe. Fourth, Native Americans are genetically derived from North Eurasian and East Asian populations, although there is a remote connection to Western Europe. And we must admit that the corpus of Upper Paleolithic or Mesolithic DNA samples preceding the Neolithic population replacement in Europe is very small. And finally, there's no archaeological evidence of a discontinuity or the arrival of a later Asian-derived population after the continent-wide expansion of Clovis people. Now, these hypothetical Solutrean voyagers would presumably have been ancestral Caucasoids. In the media, this theory has been linked to the supposed Caucasian appearance of Kennewick Man, a skeleton exposed in 1996 by the Columbia River. But Kennewick is not of Clovis age. He's only about 9,000 years old. And Jim Chatters, who did the original analysis of the skeleton, later backed away from the European identification and instead started to compare Kennewick to the Ainu Aboriginal people of Japan. Doug Owsley, a physical anthropologist at the Smithsonian, thinks that Kennewick resembles Ainu and also Polynesians, a comparison that's frankly absurd, as there were no Polynesians until Southeast Asians mingled with Melanesians during the Laputa migration into the Pacific 3,000 years ago, some 6,000 years after the death of Kennewick Man. Before Chatters moved away from the European thing, he'd made his mark by pointing out the resemblance of Jean-Luc Picard But Chatter's original reconstruction, I think, also looks a lot like the fox chief of Blackhawk from the 1830s. So take your pick. Now, Stanford and Bradley have noted an intriguing and enigmatic genetic fact in support of the European connection, which brings me to a discussion of the current state of relevant molecular genetic data. Almost all Native Americans belong to one of four mitochondrial DNA haplogroups, A, B, C, and D, each representing a female descent lineage. But a small percentage of Native North Americans belong to a fifth haplogroup called X. It's particularly frequent among the Ojibwe. Haplogroup X is also present in Europeans and is most concentrated in the Druze sect of the Levant. Does this indicate a European or Near Eastern ancestry for the American X group? Not necessarily. The X2A clade is only found in North America, and its divergence from European and Central Asian clades occurred about 14,000 years ago. The origin of American X remains unresolved, but it seems to be traceable ultimately to the Near East and not Iberia. Over the past decade, analyses of mitochondrial DNA, Y chromosomes, and whole genomes have converged on the conclusion that all Native Americans, except the Inuit and the Athapascans of the far north, descend from a single rapid migration out of Beringia. The dates calculated for this migration are variable, depending on assumptions about the mutation rate. Too often, for my taste, researchers choose a rate that permits people to arrive at Monte Verde before 14,500. But there's no question that an arrival date of more than 16,000 years is very improbable. Apart from X, the other American mitochondrial haplogroups are ubiquitous in Eastern Asia and very rare or absent from Europe and Africa. But specifically, American clades of these haplogroups either developed here soon after the ancestral founders arrived, or they were not very common in Eastern Asia, and they've disappeared there over the last 14,000 years. It's important to note that no living Asian population is the unchanged ancestor of the Native Americans. The closest relationships seem to be, nevertheless, with southern Siberian groups, particularly in the Altai Mountains. According to the latest research, there are 15 mitochondrial clades in the Americas, which implies that the founding population included at least 15 unrelated women. On the other hand, there seems to have been only one male lineage in the founding population. Soon after arrival south of the ice, or maybe just before that, a mutation arose that divided this ancestral Y chromosome lineage into two branches, the ancestral line called QL54 and the descendant line called QM3. The Q haplogroup is very rare in China and non-existent farther south, and that fact alone seems to rule out any significant Southeast Asian or Australian role in the origin of Native Americans. So what are we to make of the resemblance, which has been pointed out for many years, of early Holocene American skulls, which are often rugged and long-headed, to those of Australian Aborigines or Melanesians? W.H. Howells, famous physical anthropologist, noted back in the 60s that Native American skulls occasionally appeared similar to European and even African crania. Walter Neves, Brazilian anthropologist, and his colleagues have been postulating since the 1980s two migrations into the Americas. First, Australo-Melanesian-like people, ultimately of African origin, arrive maybe 17,000 years ago in a coastal migration. And then 13,000 years ago, a Mongoloid population with skulls similar to those of modern North Asians and Native Americans, presumably bearing Clovis culture, enters interior North America and then moves into South America and replaces the Australo-Melanesians about 10,000 years ago. These skulls are often cited in the work by Neves and his colleagues. They're from California, Baja California, and they're quite recent in age. So the argument is made that somehow this Paleo-American type is sort of frozen into place in Baja California, and subsequent population waves didn't affect them. Some papers also mention native people of Tierra del Fuego as primitive survivors. Neves claims to disown the old idea that somehow Australians had gotten to the Americas very early, but by a Pacific migration. But he has no archaeological evidence of a coastal migration down the Pacific by people with such physical traits. And Clovis cannot represent a highly derived or classic Mongoloid population because there's no evidence that there was such a population in East Asia before some 9,000 years ago. Now, in the press, Neve's ideas have been linked to the claims made by the Franco-Brazilian archaeologist Nied Guidon and her colleagues of a human occupation some 50,000 years ago or maybe earlier at Pedra Furada and other rock overhangs in northeastern Brazil. Now, in 1993, Adivasio, the Meadowcroft excavator, Dillehay of Monteverde fame, and David Meltzer visited Pedra Furada. They examined the supposed pebble tools, and they declared them geofacts that they thought had been created when rainwater torrents had sent rocks crashing down from the roof of the shelter to the floor. In 2013, Guidon's colleagues claimed to have 22,000-year-old stone tools at a rock shelter called Toca da Tirapeia. Most of these things probably are geofacts accidentally created by rocks dropping on other rocks, but I caused some controversy by suggesting recently that some of them might have been made by monkeys. There are Capuchin monkeys that live near these sites, and today they use stone tools that look amazingly like some of these Pedra Furada artifacts for nutcracking and other purposes. Dillehay was quoted in the New York Times as calling this a stupid idea, and I will just call his criticism ignorant. Generally, the proponents of alternative origins of Native Americans avoid the genetic evidence because it completely contradicts their assertions. Southeast Asians, Australians, Melanesians, and Ainu completely lack the Y chromosome haplogroup Q that characterizes over 90% of Native American males. That haplotype is haplogroup is also very rare in China and Japan, where haplogroups D and O are prevalent. And one has to ask if Salutrian migrants populated the Americas, as Dennis Stanford proposes. Oops. That may be true, but okay, thank you. Why didn't they bring Y haplogroup I or mitochondrial haplogroup U, which are the ubiquitous types that have been found in recently sampled Mesolithic skeletons from Spain to Sweden? The only way out of this conundrum is to postulate total replacement of the hypothetical early population by Mongoloids, and there's no archaeological evidence for that later intrusion. In an article that I published 10 years ago, I summarized the genetic evidence that was then available as indicating an ancient overlapping of two ancestral gene pools in southern and central Siberia, one that encompassed the female mitochondrial DNA lineages of America, northern China, and Mongolia, and the other, a male line that leads back through Central Asia to Europe. I'll quote myself. Paleo-Indian ancestors may have emerged as the product of genetic and cultural exchanges around Lake Baikal between proto-Mongoloid natives, mainly females, and proto-Caucasoids, mainly males, who carried the Russian Upper Paleolithic complex into the region around 45,000 BP, along with Y-chromosome haplotype P and mitochondrial haplotype X. This mixed Siberian population was the source of the main Paleo-Indian migration into Beringia around 14,000 to 13,500 calendar years ago. End quote. Now, I feel completely vindicated by recent studies of ancient DNA. We now have complete genomes of a 24,000-year-old boy from the southern Siberian Upper Paleolithic site of Malta and a 12,900-year-old toddler from the Anzac site in Montana. The Malta boy, or MA1, has European-type Y chromosome, as haplogroup R, which shares a deep common ancestry with Native American Q, and mitochondrial DNA, also haplogroup U. That's another old European type. However, in the rest of the genome, the autosomes indicate an ancestral relationship to Native Americans. And I will quote from Raghavan et al. We estimate that 14 to 38% of Native American ancestry may originate through gene flow from this ancient population. This is likely to have occurred after the divergence of Native American ancestors from East Asian ancestors, but before the diversification of Native American populations in the New World. Gene flow from the MA1, that's the Malta, lineage into Native American ancestors could explain why several crania from the first Americans have been reported as bearing morphological characteristics that do not resemble those of East Asians. Now, this Maltar genome also is ancestral to some Europeans. New evidence suggests that there is an ancient North Eurasian element in Europe, particularly in northern populations. The population carrying these genes may have been the ones who brought Siberian-derived early pottery into northeastern Europe about 9,000 years ago. The Anzac toddler was discovered accidentally in 1968 in Montana. He was accompanied by about 110 artifacts, including Clovis points and bifaces and shafts made of elk antler, all covered with red ochre. The toddler's genome is proven to be ancestral to all Central and South American natives and most North Americans. His mitochondrial DNA type is a D4H3, which is quite rare today, but occurs mainly in populations of Western South America. The same variant of D was found in the 10,500-year-old man from On Your Knees Cave on the Alaska coast. The Y chromosome type of the Anzac boy is QL54, XM3, meaning lacking the M3 mutation. This is the ancestral and relatively less common variant of American Q. Now, the authors of this recent science paper, Nature paper, looked at several alternatives, and the two that work as models are that Anzac branches off the South American ancestral line just after the North America-South America split, or that it's at the root, but slightly after the split, and there's been additional influence from a later migration, probably by the Athapascans, with gene flow into North American but not South American populations. Now, I have to mention, See those rods, those antler rods were dated directly. Both came out 11,040. And my colleague, Julie Morrow, looked at them macroscopically, microscopically, and she was convinced that they had to be made of elk or wapiti antler. And there's evidence from Alaska, new dating done about 8 years ago by Dale Guthrie. This is where elk begin to appear in Alaska, about 12,600 radiocarbon years. And the earliest human sites are 12,300 radiocarbon years. So it looks like elk and people are coming across the land bridge and then down into North America at the same time. Those artifacts from Anzac are the oldest evidence of elk south of the ice sheets. And in the same study where they got DNA from the toddler, they also got DNA from the elk antler artifacts, and they are of the same clade genetically as the wapiti or elk in Alaska. And both of those are a derivative branch from the red deer of Eurasia. So it all works out quite nicely. Now, recently, the skeleton of a teenage girl was found in a huge drowned cavern in the Yucatan called Hoyo Negro. This seems to date to about 12 to 13,000 years. The DNA was not as well preserved as the Anzac DNA, but it was typed as a D1 haplotype, which is a typical Native American type. Interestingly, the leader of the team who did this work was Jim Chatters. It was the same guy who said that Kennewick man looked European and implied multiple migrations. But now, despite the typically rugged features of this skull from Hoyo Negro, Chatters admits that the genetic evidence indicates a single Paleo-Indian migration followed by in-situ microevolutionary change toward a more gracile morphology. Now, he took some flack for suggesting that this was the result of a process of self-domestication of what he called an ancestral wild or savage population. But less provocatively, we can say that after 10,000 years ago, Native Americans began to cultivate plants and they become more sedentary. Early archaic people used grinding stones to process roots, seeds, and nuts. Maybe these new food sources and the new technology somehow selected for smaller teeth, reduced orofacial musculature, and thus more globular heads. The higher density of the more sedentary foragers and cultivators would have fostered the spread of their genes into less numerous marginal hunter-gatherer populations. It also became warmer in the early Holocene, and smaller-bodied individuals may have been better adapted to this climate. So about 45,000 years ago, anatomically, modern humans with an upper Paleolithic blade-based technology arrived in southern Siberia, where, curiously, they did not interbreed with the resident archaic humans of the area, the Denisovans, known from DNA from a single pinky bone, and the Neanderthals, who were also resident in Siberia. By about 32,000 years ago, they were at least seasonally venturing into the far north, where they hunted horses, rhinos, and mammoth. We have evidence of a camp of that age in northern Siberia, where some wonderful artifacts were made at the Yana RHS site. While people evidently had the technology and the logistical skills at that date for survival in the far north, they evidently did not cross the land bridge into eastern Beringia, that is Alaska, for another 18,000 years. One can only speculate why. I like to point out that, you know, we have the historical example of the Chinese with their giant exploring junks who got as far as the tip of southern Africa and then turned back. And, you know, if they'd continued on up to Europe, world history would have been very different. But they didn't. These people were poised at the western edge of Beringia. They could have gotten into the New World at that date. They didn't. Because if they had, we'd be finding artifacts like these instead of those miserable broken rocks in Brazil. The oldest dates we have from Alaska come from the Swan Point campsite in central Alaska. That's about 14,300 calendar years. Pollen and beetle studies show it was warmer than present in Alaska at that time. The ice-free corridor to the south, which had been closed by coalescence of the ice sheets during the last glacial maxima, may have opened a bit when rapid warming occurred at 14,700 years ago. That's the Bolling warming. And it must have widened quite a bit at 13,800 when there's a major melt of the Laurentide ice sheet, which is evident in a flux of fresh water that can be traced down the Mississippi into the Gulf of Mexico. There were rapid changes about 13,500 years ago in vegetation and in lake levels in Alaska, and it may have been these changes, particularly affecting the migratory waterfowl, which were going up and down the corridor, and on which these earliest Alaskan people depended for a lot of their food, that may have spurred a Paleo-Indian macro band to explore the unknown corridor. These are some of the earliest tools from Alaska, not very Clovis-looking. Something happened between Alaska and the south of the ice sheets that really changed technology. I mentioned the evidence for waterfowl. At Malta, where that boy was buried 24,000 years ago, there are these wonderful ivory figurines of flying swans, and 40% of the meat from the Broken Mammoth site, one of the earliest Alaskan sites, consists of swans, geese, and ducks. That's the route that's followed today by tundra swans in their migration seasonally from the Alaska coast down to the east coast of the U.S. So perhaps the founders were, like recent subarctic people, normally living in macro bands of about 150 people. This might account for the 15 women of the distinct mitochondrial lineages who were ancestors, and there seem to have been at least two men in the original group with closely related Y chromosomes of the Q haplogroup. And perhaps this implies a patrilineal, patrilocal society in the ancestral situation. So, again, that Alaskan stuff doesn't look terribly like Clovis. There are a few fluted points in Alaska. They appear to be very late, only about 12,000 years, not 13,000 plus. So we haven't found ancestral fluted points as of yet in Alaska. And as I said, this does pose a problem because by about 20,000 years ago, everybody in Northeast Asia was using microblades. And clearly there is movement of the microblade tradition into Alaska. The Denali culture, which is already evident at the Swan Point site, does use microblades. And Clovis has no microblades. It's one of the reasons Dennis Stanford started looking to Europe instead of Northern Asia. We do have to explain this somehow. I'll just say, you know, we shouldn't sort of get into a tizzy about this. Other cultures have shifted. In Ireland, in the Mesolithic, there's a shift from microblades to macroblades. So it happens. Soon after the Paleo Indians arrived in North America, there was an abrupt and massive die-off of megafauna between 11,400 and 10,800 radiocarbon years. The extinctions of 16 genera are dated unambiguously by numerous assays directly on bone, and there are another 16 that are rare in the fossil record, but they probably also vanished in the same period. Now, it's true that there was a dramatic warming at 14,700 calendar years, the Bolling warming, and then it got cold again at 12,800, the Younger Dryas. But these animals had existed for hundreds of thousands or millions of years and had survived more drastic climate swings. This fact alone makes the climatic cause of their sudden demise very implausible. Some researchers have been arguing since 2007 that there's evidence in the form of nanodiamonds and carbon and iron spherules that a comet airburst occurred at the onset of the Younger Dryas and had enormous environmental effects. The jury's still out on that, but the close correspondence of human arrival and megafaunal extinction is very suspicious. And the same thing happens a few centuries later in South America, where some 50 genera went extinct. Clovis points, which are demonstrably well-designed to kill mammoths, are found everywhere between 11,200 and 10,900 radiocarbon years in North America. They've been found amid the bones of mammoths, for instance, at Naco and Lena in Arizona, and mastodons at the Kimmswick site in Missouri. 14 such kill butchery sites are known that everybody agrees are undeniably kill sites, and that's an extraordinary number compared to the record of human predation in the old world. Brief aside, Paleo Indians' rapid expansion may well have been facilitated by the domestication of dogs. Genetic evidence is pointing increasingly to a single domestication event for the dog about 16,000 years ago. There are early archaic dogs from the Koster site, 9,000 years old. They have the same genes as old world dogs. So almost certainly the Paleo Indians brought dogs. The dogs no doubt helped them in hunting, transporting stuff as they made their rapid treks. And I think it's a possibility to consider that the dogs might have carried some old world disease, maybe canine distemper or the like, which could have played a role in the die-off of the big carnivores in the Americas, and that might have had a whole sort of cascading effect on the entire ecosystem. Another recent kill site, really interesting one, in northwestern Mexico, in Sonora, a gomphotheer kill. It had been thought that gomphotheers had disappeared from North and Central America thousands of years earlier than this, but this site is dated by one good radiocarbon date to about 13,400 calendar years, and obviously classic Clovis points. Another possibly early site, I mentioned East Wenatchee before. East Wenatchee is a case where the artifacts were deposited right after a large eruption of Glacier Peak up in the northwest, and until recently that was dated as about 13,200 years, and now seems to be 13,600 years. Three of these artifacts had particles of the tephra adhering to them, which seems to indicate that they were laid down right after the eruption on a layer of tephra. So these may be among the earliest Clovis artifacts, and interestingly, they're up in the far northwest, not far from the mouth of the Ice Free Corridor. Another point to emphasize about the Sonoran site is that there's a whole landscape of Clovis sites, and it's located there, and that's the Sea of Cortez. There's the Pacific Coast, Baja California. This doesn't leave any room for a hypothetical coastal population keeping Clovis out of the coastal zone. There's nobody there except Clovis. Wrapping up now. Given the early dates, Clovis might have first developed in Texas or northern Mexico. Despite what you may have read, there is a documented Clovis presence in South America. These are from the coast of Venezuela, a site called El Cayude. All surface finds, unfortunately, not excavated in situ. Clovis-like fluted points also have been found in Chile. In fact, not far from Monteverde. And that site is called Quebrada Santa Julia. A fluted biface was found along with a butchered horse, many pieces of debitage, deeply stratified, and with dates of 11,090, 11,060, and 10,920 radiocarbon years. So roughly 12,900 calendar years ago. There's a stylistic continuum that to me seems quite obvious as you go from Clovis points to North America through slightly wasted fishtailed points in Central America, and you wind up with the full fishtailed points in South America, with astonishing similarity between points from Belize to Argentina to Uruguay. I mean, I look at these and I think they could have been made by the same person. Remarkably similar. So by 12,800 calendar years ago, hunters making fishtail points had reached the southern tip of South America. Within several hundred years, almost all the megafauna of the southern continent were gone. Over the ensuing centuries, the Paleoindians settled into more constricted hunting ranges, focused on smaller game, fish and shellfish and plants, and created the regionally diversified cultural traditions that archaeologists call the archaic, but that's a story for another time. So, recap. Ancestors came from Siberia across Beringia about 14,000 calendar years ago. About 150 to 200 people, maybe a patrilineal, patrilocal macro band. Rapid migration southward, probably via an interior, not coastal route. They came with domesticated dogs. They had a diverse hunting economy with a preference for lakeside settings where, among other things, they preyed on migratory waterfowl that might have been a food source during their trek through the ice-free corridor. They spread rapidly in North America. The spread of humans is the probable main cause of megafaunal extinction. Fluted point makers reached the tip of South America by about 12,800 or 12,900 years ago, and it's possible there are pre-Clovis populations, but I think it's very doubtful. Thank you.